I try to find an excuse to say I was wrong. And then I try to do the other side of the coin, which is you were right. Some people can say I'm wrong and they can't say you were right. They could say you're right, but they can't say I'm wrong. I want people making mistakes, because if you're not making mistakes, you're just doing the same thing over and over again. You're not growing, you're not learning, you're not exploring.
Hello, and welcome to Dwayne Morris DEI 360 with Joe West. I am Unika Anderson Howard, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Manager at the firm. On today's episode, Joe is joined by Rob Rader, who is GC and Corporate Secretary of Ovation TV. During the discussion, Rob notes that he is a truly general counsel and credits his entire career and life to the transformative power of education.
Hello, everyone. This is Joe West, and I am beyond excited by our guest today, Rob Rader. Rob is the general counsel and corporate secretary at Ovation TV, but he is an extraordinary individual. He has an amazing background and career, and I think you will find this conversation to be very, very enlightening. Rob, thanks for joining me.
Joseph, this is such a pleasure. I've been looking forward to this probably my entire life without even realizing it.
Well, we're off to a good start. Tell us a little bit, first of all, about Ovation TV for those who aren't familiar. Talk a little bit about your work there, and then let's dive into your background.
So Ovation TV is a national cable network. For anyone under the age of 50, that would mean that we're on regular old TV that was cable TV that you plugged in and you had from DirecTV or Charter or Comcast, and we're in about 25 million households. So we're one of the largest independent cable networks. We're not owned by a studio. We're not owned by NBC Universal. We're not owned by Warner Brothers. Or Warner Brothers Discovery now. You know, there are fewer companies left every week. And we are always talking to possible purchasers as well, because the independent cable networks are a rare breed. The only one that most people know that's truly popular is Hallmark. And they're in about 70 million households, and they get really good ratings. But the rest of us are often squeezed. We are a network that is focused on arts and arts education. So you can imagine why nobody in America is ever watching us, which is unfortunate.
People is 30 million is nothing to sneeze at, my friend.
That's just how many households we're in. The number of people watching, you know, America could be more supportive of its arts. And we try to encourage that. So I joke about it, but we're the little engine that could. We're the little network that could, and we keep plugging away. And it's exciting to be there. So my primary job is production, distribution, and acquisition, licensing content. Most of our content is licensed from studios, from international licensors like the BBC, former studios or mini studios like MGM. But that takes up the bulk. Although, as you well know, dealing with HR or dealing with corporate matters or dealing with real estate or dealing with compliance or dealing with government relations. And frankly, and this is what I'm really fortunate, is that I do a lot of operational work. I'm effectively deputy COO. Our CFO... Yeah. Basically,
I'm so glad you made that point, because, you know, I spent a good part of my career in-house, including 5 years at the largest company in the world. I think people underappreciate, particularly at the GC level, just how many hats you wear and just how many sort of skills in your tool belt that you bring to bear on a daily basis, right?
At one point in my career, I was half in-house and half outside counsel. And it's interesting to me that you made the shift back. And I think I've heard you talk about that a little.
The reverse commute.
That's exactly what you referred to it as. And it's funny, because I felt a lot of my best skills, they're very difficult to build clients for. A lot of what you do is you find out what other people do. Oddly enough, attorneys are often a highway of information for all the different departments because they often don't talk to each other. People can sit on the same floor, can sit four offices away, and they'd have no idea what they're doing, what each other is doing. They may not have any idea of what they're doing generally, but they often really don't know what the person next to them is doing. And I'll go there and talk to the different departments. And I used to walk the hallways, and it's tough to bill a client if you're just saying, oh, I'm figuratively, let alone literally, walking your hallways. Nobody wants to pay that kind of hourly rate. But really, some of the most valuable things you can do is to get all the different departments talking and working together. And I felt that I was really good at that because I was curious and I was interested and I wanted to hear what people were doing. And then later on, I would say, did you know that, you know, someone will tell me what they're working on. Did you know that this other department, you know, digital is working on something very similar, but the regular linear distribution, people weren't even aware of it. And then you'll talk about finance and they'll have a misconception about how it's all being, you know, how are they amortizing the program acquisition cost. And the programming people won't be necessarily aware of it. And that really affects their budget. And some of them, until they get to a certain level, aren't aware of it. So there's two things that, you know, I find lawyers do that are really helpful. One, they are a clearinghouse of information. And I often find that, you know, everyone else is so interested in protecting their fiefdoms. And that's just the nature of politics in corporate America, you know, political, corporate political culture. And two, I find that when you're often, and I guess it's more of an executive in general, less so than just legal. If you're really being a great executive, there's two things I find, there's an A and a B. A, which is what I was already thinking about, was you've got to be an educator. You're always teaching people, look, I can give people a legal opinion. I can tell them what they ought to do. But if I tell them why, if I educate them, it's more like teaching a person how to fish rather than just giving them a fish. They understand why, they'll learn about it. The next time they're going to say, I think this is what you've told me in the past. And I say, that's exactly right. And you've got to really relish bringing up everybody so that we all share the same sort of information. The other thing I find that any executive should be worried about or thinking about, I spend all my time thinking about, what if I'm wrong? And how would I know it? And that how would I know it part is really a philosophical question. It's almost an epistemological question. What are the indications that I would start seeing that I'm not right, or that my advice isn't right, or that the world is not working the way I thought it would be? And that could be in a marketing promotion, you know, and I'm not doing the marketing, but they've got to figure out when something's working or when it's not. And how would they know if it's not? And so you can have an initial thing, but I'm always trying to figure out, what if I'm wrong? And that's a great lesson for kids too.
Let's go back to that sort of constellation of different areas that you bring to bear. I mean, you don't just have a passing level of knowledge about these different areas. I mean, you've worked in finance, you've handled international deals and transactions, operational issues, government relations, M&A, HR. I mean, you've been in the weeds in each of these areas.
You are very good at reading a bio. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I am indeed. But so, you know, I like to get a sense for how purposeful people are in building those sort of tools in guiding their career. Or, you know, if it just so happens that you made the decisions to make different moves and different, I know you were at two very impressive firms, Mitchell Silverberg and MoFo, and you worked at MGM as well. What were you gathering those experiences for the purpose of pointing you in the direction that you're heading? Or was it just anecdotal that you happened to find yourselves in these areas, and because you're so intellectually curious, you absorb these things like a sponge? Which one was it, Rob?
Wow, I need to have you talk to my mother. Thank you. I wish it were as purposeful. It's now more purposeful, but it's, like I said, people gain power in two ways. They either are information sharers or information hoarders. It's so much easier to work with information sharers. Some people try to hoard the information and you never know what's going on. I want to learn. I want to be around people I can learn from. So I guess in that sense, it is purposeful, because I always say, when you're looking at a job, and I say this at interviews when people want to talk to me about an opportunity, I say there's really two factors. Am I going to learn something? And am I going to have fun? And I'm pretty good at creating my own fun. And I'm pretty good at finding things to learn at. So if you give me the opportunity at a company that's doing anything that's interesting, I'm going to try to find where there's the fun. And I'm going to try to find things that I can learn. And I think I was lucky in this way. Entertainment lawyers are often very much generalists because there's less, it's not that there's less to specialize in, but you're doing contract law. You have to think about litigation consequences. That's very generally true of any transactional attorney, but you got to think about bankruptcy and secured transactions and a lot of entertainment deals. You've got to think about different jurisdictions. You've got to think about HR type issues. You got to think about guild and guild relations and a lot of what we used to do. And I won't pretend to be an expert in everyone, but I'm a good journeyman in a lot of issues. In entertainment, music is always this hidden issue that affects every piece of entertainment. And unless you have some ability to understand, you know, synchronization rights and master use licenses, you're going to be in some trouble. And you better know about a little bit about public performance royalties too. So there's all these little esoteric areas that you become a mini expert in, if not really an expert. And then once you get to the level of general counsel, there are general counsels that are truly general. And that's again, an area where I'm lucky, because I truly am a general counsel. I'll tell you this, I've gotten better and better at delegating every year. And pandemic, I got even better at, because I tried to do certain things when I wasn't in the office about making more work-life room. And work-life room, one of the things that I said I'm going to give myself as a gift is I started picking up my kids from school and therefore doing all this amount of work on the phone. And I got much better at closing. I could close 3 deals a day on the phone. And a lot of that was working through outside counsel. But that meant that I had to learn how to give up some control to get more done. And that's a really important thing to learn for your career, because, and you learn it as an early associate if you're at a law firm, because they try to tell you, look, you could write the perfect letter, but if you can delegate someone at a lower billing rate to do that letter and then just revise it, that's the more efficient solution for you and the client, because we really want you to spend your lawyer time on the thorny, tough issues that people expect to be paying your billing rate on.
So let's go back to your very impressive educational background, Harvard undergraduate, master's from Stanford, law degree from Harvard. And I should point out to our audience, probably one of the most politically connected individuals on the planet, probably knows more U.S. senators than most U.S. senators know, says a guy who lives in Washington, D.C. area right now. So talk a little bit about that whole impressive Rolodex you have, my friend. And for those of you who are below a certain age, a Rolodex is something that, you know, people would keep on their desk to keep up with their contact information.
It's like a rotary phone, except, and it does look a little like a rotary in some ways. Let me go the other way. I'm the first in my family to go straight through to college. And my grandparents, you know, certainly didn't go to college, barely made it, I think, through high school. You know, that was the time of that era. My dad dropped out of Eastern Michigan, Ypsilanti, Michigan. My mom dropped out of Michigan State to have me. Ultimately, she did go back and get a teaching degree from Florida International University when I was in elementary school. So I thank my entire career, my life, for the transformative power of education. And as you know, when you refer to my political involvement, I worked on a couple of presidential campaigns. But I always wanted, as one of my goals was to think globally, but act locally. So I got involved in my local politics. I've been an elected official. I'm in my 20th year as an elected official in California for Santa Monica College, which is the number one transfer institution in the state of California. And we are the number one transfer institution to UCLA, USC, Loyola Marymount University, Pepperdine University. We are a really amazing institution. And I wanted to help give back for students coming up now to have the transformative power of education in their lives too. I wanted to be able to give what education had done for me back to another generation of students. And let me say this, the community college student is someone that doesn't assume that he or she is going to necessarily get to college. They value it. We have people that come 20, 30 miles to get to Santa Monica College. And though it's called Santa Monica College, we are a regional asset. We help 25 to 30,000 students a year. And I feel, you know, our slogan, our college motto is changing lives through excellence in education. And we really hold ourselves to that mission. Now, are we always doing it perfectly? No. And I got to tell you, this has been a challenging time. And we too have struggled with how do we make that education fully available to all. And honestly, coming out of my graduate degree, you mentioned I was going to become a professor of sociology. I was getting a PhD in sociology. So I consider myself at least fairly comfortable with statistics and how you would measure social science. And I don't think that we actually even look at education necessarily always right. And it's very difficult to get accountability into any of these systems, as you know, because education, we typically measure inputs, not outputs. Right. And it becomes very difficult. And we are what's referred to as a Hispanic serving institution. Over 40% of our students are Latino. About 10 to 12% are African American. About 30+% are white, and another just under 10% are Asian American Pacific Islander. So we are a very diverse college, even though you wouldn't necessarily think Santa Monica, the city, and the other city in our area is perhaps even less considered, not as thought of as diverse, is Malibu, even though there are absolutely pockets of diversity throughout all these places. But we really serve the entire region, and I'm really proud of that. I'm excited about it. And
That's so admirable. And I will tell you, I serve on the board of trustees of Xavier University of Louisiana. Xavier is the number one institution for African-American pharmacists and African-American physicians in the country. And one of the things that I noticed is just how cost prohibitive higher education can be for a lot of people, even more so now, particularly as resources to sort of mitigate that become more sort of constricted. The community college system can play such a critical role in helping to sort of combat that issue.
We are the source of diversity for the entire UC system. I didn't want to go into every statistic, but we are the number one source of African-Americans for the UC system. We're number one to UCLA. I mean, as you know, the UC system lost a lot of its diversity when they stopped being able to take race into account. Without the community college system, and I include Santa Monica College in that very much so, I question how much diversity there would be at some of the campuses. And again, I'm also really proud of that. At the same time, I often think that we don't hold ourselves to tough questions, and we, you know, sometimes data is the best way. And I often feel that because data can tell you things that you don't want to hear, you're not necessarily doing the students a favor by not letting them hear that and by not confronting some of those really tough realities. And I met you because you were someone that didn't shy away from saying tough things and help them open up that space. And I have to be, you know, and being utterly honest, when I try to bring up some of those issues, it's not as easy for someone that's a middle-aged straight white guy to bring up some of the tougher issues. And I have to find my colleagues to kind of be the laboring oar. And I said, I think that this is how I would do it, because I always say, what do I want for my kids? And my kids are applying to college now. And I don't want to think of an us versus them kids. This is good enough for these kids. It's not good enough for these kids. Right. There are plenty of kids that go to community college that transfer on. And we're very proud of the number of kids we transfer to extremely excellent schools across the nation. And we are a great source of that. So we could talk all day about community colleges and some of my pride about it, but even some of my disappointments in what I'm able to change in the system. And, you know, every year I have to evaluate, am I still doing a job that I'm bringing passion to it? And I still am. And I still will sometimes take a vote to send a symbolic message to the college or to my administrators that I don't think we're doing a good enough job. And if I have to be an outlier, someone's got to stand up and maybe a hammer comes down and hits that nail. Or sometimes maybe I can be a squeaky wheel and get some grease going for the entire system.
Rob, what is it that motivates you in this vein? I mean, your background, your experience, your accomplishments, you certainly don't have to be involved with the community college. You don't have to be involved with downtown Santa Monica. I know you're involved with that, and you're on the board of KCRW. What is it that motivates you from a community service standpoint?
I didn't have a good answer necessarily for that. That wasn't like eight, nine years ago. A certain generation of my mentors started passing away. And you're probably familiar with that too. And I had to go to a lot of funerals. And I noticed that there were three things that were mentioned at funerals that made for a life that you could tell that everyone admired. One, their commitment to their family. And that's what you heard me talk about, work-life distinctions. And I tell people all the time, you got to look out for your health. I never want anyone that works for me giving up their doctor's appointments. I say, you know, spend that time with your kids. You're not going to get it back. So family and friends to a lesser degree, but really your personal relationships. Two, believe it or not, work always matters. And I know you believe it, but maybe people that are younger don't always believe it. But having something that you go to every day, and I always hire, you want to hire on smarts, you want to hire on willingness to work, you want to hire people that care. And having something that you care about professionally turned out to be very important in a lot of in these funerals, in every single one of those funerals that I respected people. And the third thing was giving a damn about something else and showing that there was something else in your life that you committed to and that you tried to make a difference in. And those are the lives that I saw that I wanted to emulate. And I was really lucky that somehow I had blundered into some of that. And look, we all have to admit that you want to matter. You want to give back. You want to be useful. If I think I know something and I think I'm a good board member and I'm a great person to disagree with because I can do it, I can disagree without being disagreeable most of the time. Don't ask my ex-wife that question. If you're going to do an interview with her, I'm going to plead the fifth. But you also have to be willing to listen. And again, to admit mistakes. The one thing I'm always trying to do is I try to find an excuse to say I'm wrong or I was wrong. And then I try to do the other side of the coin, which is you were right. Some people could say I'm wrong and they can't say you were right.
So true.
Or they could say you're wrong, you're right, but they can't say I'm wrong. I try to own both of those statements, and I try to model it for my kids and my team, because I want people making mistakes, because if you're not making mistakes, you're just doing the same thing over and over again. You're not growing. You're not learning. You're not exploring. You're not part of a learning organization. Now, don't keep making the same mistake over and over again. Try to learn from the make different mistakes all the time.
Exactly.
But make some mistakes, and that's okay. And I'm always trying to give permission to make mistakes. And I've dealt with certain bosses, you know, and you're hesitant to explain to them what happened because they're going to beat you up for the mistake. And my rule is don't come to me with problems. Come to me with proposed solutions. Yeah. And you can admit the mistake. And as long as that, this is how I propose dealing with it. And I said, have you considered this? Because that's what my good bosses did for me. Have you thought about this? Have you tried that? And that's a productive conversation that leads to constructive results. That leads to productive results, a constructive approach that leads to productive results for the company, for yourself, for team building. And I can't recommend it enough. I'm wrong all the time. I've been wrong on things I probably said right now.
Well, that is the one thing I will disagree with you on, my friend. Listen, Rob, I can't thank you enough. I can't tell you how much of a pleasure this has been. I'll just say this, I've interviewed a lot of people. This is probably one of the most insightful and enjoyable conversations that I've had. So thank you for making time.
A broken clock is right twice a day. So I thank you for those your comments have all been super generous, Joseph. And I do appreciate it. And the opportunity that you provide, the platform for especially younger attorneys or younger professionals to really learn. I admire that what you're giving back and what you've done at Duane Morris is a real example. And I met you through the Minority Corporate Counsel Association. And I refer to what you said at that all the time to people. And I say, your courage and your example continue to inspire me. And what can I then do in the same vein that Joseph West does? So thank you.
Wow. Listen, I don't know if I deserve that, but I'll take it, my friend. Thank
you,
Rob.
We feel the same way about each other then.
Let's do it. Next time I'm out in California, the drinks are on me.
I will accept.
Thank you, my friend.